I wanted to be the last to say Happy Valentine's Day to you. Did you all have a nice Happy Valentine's Day? My husband and I went out the night before on Thursday because we were afraid that, you know, Friday was going to be absolutely insane since it was Valentine's Day and everybody had cabin fever. Well, the whole world had cabin fever already on Thursday. It was a disaster. But Valentine's Day is all about love. And I sent my newsletter this month and talked about how we get love so messed up in this world, don't we? I mean, you know, you watch the commercials ahead of Valentine's Day and it just makes you want to just, you know, this is not what God intended for love to be. But today we're going to talk about love. We're going to talk about holy living and being changed by love. Have any of you ever been changed by another person's love, by another human being's love? My husband changed me. He jokingly says that he pulled me out of the gutter. But truly, his love changed me. When we were dating, I was young, 25-ish, I think. And my husband, you need to understand, my husband, even before he came to know Christ, he's a very good man. He's a very ethical man. He had a very strong sense of right and wrong, even before he came to know Jesus. So when we were dating and we started to really care for each other, one of the things that I did that changed about me because of his love for me is that I quit smoking. I had smoked cigarettes since I was 15, so I'd been smoking a pack a day for about 10 years. And, of course, he told me that kissing me was like kissing a dirty ashtray. So that was a little bit of motivation. But truly, the motivation was I wanted to show him how much I loved him because he loved me. And so in the middle of a New Year's Eve party, 11:59, I smoked my last cigarette. And after that, I quit. And it wasn't for me because I wanted to be healthy. It was because I wanted to show him I loved him. The other way that I changed because of his love for me is that in addition to this, you know, strong sense of right and wrong and this strong ethical side of him, he also had very high expectations for himself and very high expectations for the people around him. So he treated me like a lady. He treated me like a lady, like no other man had ever treated me. And I wanted to be that lady. Now you have to understand that in those days, this is true confession time, I had a truck driver's mouth. I went to an all-girls Catholic high school, and if you want to hear truck drivers, you listen to a whole bunch of little teenage girls on a bus when there's no boys around. Oh, my gosh. And I carried that truck driver mouth with me into my young adult years. But my husband never, ever used any bad language, ever. And I, you know, I'd find myself, if he's not talking like this, then why am I? When he treats me and he puts me on a pedestal. So his love changed me. But God's amazing love changed me even more. I've been a believer for about 30 years, 31 years. And throughout those years, God is always giving me new challenges. He's always trying to make me more like him. And have you ever noticed how God works on one thing at a time? When we came to Atlanta, he worked on my pride in a job that just took away all my pride. And he worked on my control freakness. But he didn't let go of that until I got it. So if I didn't get the lesson, whatever the lesson was he was teaching, no matter how hard that lesson was, if I didn't get it, I better be careful because he's going to, you know, keep me there till I get it. Just a little side on that. That's a reminder for us to never judge somebody else. If he's working on you about your potty mouth and you hear someone else using language that you think, well, she shouldn't use that language. She's a believer. Or what kind of believer is she? God may not be working on that on her right now. He may be working on something else and he's not done with that and he'll get to the mouth. Have you, you know, no worries. He'll get to it. So the interesting thing is that right now, here I am teaching on holy living and my most recent challenge is submission and obedience. He's been reminding me over and over and over that grace isn't against obedience, that yes, I love you, I give you unconditional love, but I love you enough to want to make you holy. So he's challenging me in that way. And that's been especially hard for me because, see, I was brought up in a very legalistic religion. I was brought up thinking and understanding that God was up in heaven somewhere and he was keeping score. In the faith that I grew up in, you were taught that Jesus saved you and that Jesus was the way to go to heaven, but it was Jesus plus good works. It was Jesus plus do. I learned a lot of legalism. And when I obeyed out of fear. I didn't obey out of love. Love had nothing to do with my obedience. I obeyed out of fear of going to hell. Henry T. Blackaby, who is the author of Experiencing God, said, "Obedience without love is legalism. Obedience for its own sake can be nothing more than perfectionism, which leads to pride. God looks beyond your godly habits, beyond your moral lifestyle, and beyond your church involvement, and focuses his penetrating gaze upon your heart." Is that not awesome? And when I came to know the love of Christ, my response was completely different. I learned when I came to know Christ, the pastor that taught us that religion is do, but Christianity says it's done. God said to me, "I love you. Say yes to me, Mary, and I will change your heart." And the truth is, in all of those years, one step at a time, he's changed me. I'm not the same person that I was 30 years ago. I've been changed by God's amazing love. Now, today's text is in 1 Peter 3, verses 1 through 7. And it really is about changed lives. Let's go there and read it first. I'm reading from the NIV, just so you know. "Wives, in the same way, be submissive to your husbands, so that if any of them do not believe the word, they may be won over without words by the behavior of their wives when they see the purity and reverence of your lives." That's holy living, ladies. "Your beauty should not come from outward adornment, such as braided hair and the wearing of gold jewelry and fine clothes. Instead, it should be that of your inner self, the unfading beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is of great worth in God's sight. For this is the way the holy women of the past who put their hope in God used to make themselves beautiful. They were submissive to their own husbands, like Sarah, who obeyed Abraham and called him her master. You are her daughters if you do what is right and do not give way to fear. Husbands, in the same way, be considerate as you live with your wives and treat them with respect as the weaker partner and as heirs with you of the gracious gift of life, so that nothing will hinder your prayers. Peter's teaching here about submission in marriage, but I believe he's teaching more than that. He's teaching about submission to God and holy living. You notice how it says, in the same way, wives, be submissive to your husband. He's referring back to those passages beforehand where he was talking about submitting to earthly authorities and to the government, to masters, employers. He's talking about submission in general. And the question you have to ask yourself is, why is he asking us to submit to earthly authorities? Can't we just submit to God without submitting to earthly authorities? Karen talked about this a couple weeks back. The fact is that submission changes lives. Submission changes our lives and it changes other people's lives. When we submit, chapter 3 of Peter says, wives, in the same way, submit to your husbands so that if any of them does not believe, they may be won over by your holy living. And in chapter 2 and verse 12, he says, live such good lives among the pagans that although they accuse you of doing wrong, they may see your good deeds, your submission, your holy living, and glorify God. Our submission points people to Christ. But that's not all it does. It also changes us. It is what helps us to let God change us. So as you're doing your homework this week, as you're going through lesson 5 in your book, although the passage that he uses is this about marriage, especially for those of you who are not married women, look at this in that way. Look at it in the respect that he's talking about submission in total and submission to God. So for the rest of our time together today, we're going to talk about 3 important questions about holy living, about changed lives. We're going to look at our motivation for change. So what makes us want to be holy and live holy lives? We're going to look at the power for change. How do we live holy lives? What gives us the power to do that? And then thirdly, we're going to look at the war against change. We're going to look at what gets in the way of us choosing holy living. So let's start with our motivation for change. What is it that makes us want to be holy? Motivation is everything. If you're a mother or a grandparent, if your children obey you because they're afraid of you, that's not exactly what you want, is it? Don't you want your kids to obey you because they know how much you love them and they know that the things that you're telling them to do are for their own good because you're crazy about them? Charles Spurgeon said, "When I thought God was hard, I found it easy to sin. But when I found God so kind, so good, so overflowing with compassion, I beat my breast to think I could ever have rebelled against one who loved me so and sought my good." Obedience, submission, is our response to God's love, not the other way around. He doesn't love us because we're obedient. We're obedient because he loves us. 1 John 4:19 says, we love him because he first loved us. We can't earn His love by our obedience. Ephesians 2:18 says, "And I pray that you, being rooted and established in love, may have the power, together with all the Lord's holy people, to grasp how wide and how long and how high and how deep is the love of Christ." When that amazing love goes from your head into your heart, our natural response is, how can I please you? How can I show you how much I love you in return? So let's talk a little bit about that amazing love. Did you know that you matter to God? Did you know that you are valuable to Him? That He is madly, passionately in love with you? Jesus wanted us to get that. He wanted us to get that so much that in Luke 15, He told three stories, three parables right in a row, and they're three different stories, but they all have the same lesson. The lesson that you matter to God. There's the story of the lost sheep. We all know those stories. The lost sheep, the shepherd had 100 sheep, and one of them got lost. And when the one got lost, he left the 99, and he went and he searched and searched and searched until he found that lost sheep. And when he found that lost sheep, he gently picked it up, put it over his shoulders, and brought it back to the fold. And then what did he do? He called his friends to celebrate. He said, "My sheep, my valuable sheep, was lost and I found it. Come and celebrate with me." And the next parable, the lost coin. The woman loses a valuable coin. And she sweeps her entire house and she tears her house apart from top to bottom until she finally finds that lost coin, because that coin was valuable to her. She didn't stop looking until she found it. And then what did she do? She called her friends and said, "Celebrate with me. My valuable coin was lost and I found it." And the prodigal son, my favorite story. The son asks his father for his inheritance early and says, "I want my money. I'm going to go see if I can make my fortune in the city." Well, in those days, you didn't do that. That was totally against the norm of those times. That was insulting that a son would ask his father for his money. But he did. He didn't care. He went off to the city and spent the money on women and booze and whatever else he spent the money on. And then when he ran out of money and he was in need, he put his tail between his legs and came home to daddy. But what did the daddy do while the boy was off blowing all of his inheritance? He watched for him. Every single day, the word tells us, he watched the horizon for his son. He loved his boy enough to not go and force him to come home. But he watched every single day and prayed and waited for his son to return. And when his son returned with his tail between his legs, wanting to just be a servant because he didn't deserve anything more, what did the father do? He threw his arms around his boy. He celebrated. He called all of his friends and said, "Celebrate with me. My son was lost and now he's found." That's how much God loves us. And He seeks us like the woman seeking the coin. And He doesn't just seek us for our salvation. Once we're saved, once we're His daughters, He doesn't stop seeking us. He still seeks us when we choose to go our own way, when we forget about him for a while, when we decide we're angry with him and we don't want to talk to him for 2 years, he waits patiently and he woos us back because he's crazy about us. And our response to that kind of love, just like when I responded to my husband loving me, our response is that we want to please him. His amazing love is our motivation. His love gives us the desire to please him. His love gives us the power to submit and to say yes to him. His love gives us the endurance to run the good race and get up when we fall. And make no mistake about it, ladies, you are going to fall. As long as we're on this side of heaven, we will fall over and over and over again. We're going to talk more about that later when we talk about the battle. So his love gives us the desire to change. But what gives us the power to change and to live holy lives? The good news is that God loves us so much that he doesn't just save us and then say, okay, go do it yourself now. I want you to be holy. Go do it. He does it for us. The word is sanctification. It's from a Hebrew word that means to set apart or to separate for God. Sanctification is God's work. He changes us. But our loving God is a gentleman. He will never force us. Even in his work of salvation, in his work of sanctification, God lovingly allows us to have free will. We can choose whether to say yes or no as he works in us and tries to change us and make us look more like Jesus. So what is it that helps us to make a choice for holy living? Charles Spurgeon said, if you would be holy, you must live close to Jesus. Even Peter, who wrote this book that we're studying, learned that the hard way. Come with me to Matthew 14, verse 25. We're going to read a very, very familiar story. During the fourth watch of the night, Jesus went out to them walking on the lake. When the disciples saw him walking on the lake, they were terrified. It's a ghost, they said, and cried out in fear. But Jesus immediately said to them, take courage. It is I. Don't be afraid. Lord, if it's you, Peter replied, tell me to come to you on the water. Come, he said. Then Peter got down out of the boat, walked on the water, and came toward Jesus. But when he saw the wind, he was afraid. And beginning to sink, he cried out, Lord, save me. Immediately Jesus reached out his hand and caught him. You of little faith, he said, why did you doubt? Peter was walking in a miracle. Talk about being set apart. None of the other apostles were brave enough to say, I want to do it, I want to do it, I want to do it. Only Peter, gutsy Peter, was the one who said, come on, Lord, let me come to you. And he did. He was walking in a miracle. As long as he kept his eyes on Jesus and depended on Jesus, he walked on water. But as soon as he took his eyes off of Jesus, as soon as he looked at his circumstances, as soon as he depended on himself, he sank. If we want to be set apart and walk in the miracle of our sanctification, we have to keep our eyes on Jesus. We have to depend on his power, not our own. Don't ever make the mistake of thinking that you can make yourself holy. Because when you begin to make that mistake, you leave yourself wide open for the enemy's lies. Which brings us into the war. What gets in the way of our holy living? You don't have to be a believer very long before you become very aware that we as followers of Jesus Christ are in a war. There is a world that we can't see that is very real, and we have become the enemy of the enemy. Ephesians 6 tells us that our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the powers of this dark world, and against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realms. And we're told to put on God's armor, not our armor, God's armor, including His breastplate of righteousness. But even that breastplate is not our righteousness. It is Christ's. Romans 3:10 says there is no one righteous, not even one. Romans 3:20 says, therefore, no one will be declared righteous in God's sight by works of the law. Rather, through the law, we become conscious of our sin. Romans 4:5 says, however, to the one who does not work but trusts God, who justifies the ungodly, their faith is credited to them as righteousness. And Isaiah 61:10 says, we wear the robes of His righteousness. But His righteousness, the righteousness that we receive the instant we are saved, is at war with our flesh, our sinful nature. Because salvation, the day that we are saved, our sinful nature doesn't go away. Until we get to the other side, until we get to heaven, we have a sinful nature and a new nature that are at war with each other. I don't know if any of you have ever gone to a website called gotquestions.org, but it's a great website for asking any and all questions with regard to the Christian faith. And gotquestions.org says, at the moment of conversion, the Christian receives a new nature. It's instantaneous. Sanctification, on the other hand, is the process by which God develops our new nature, enabling us to grow more into holiness through time. This is a continuous process with many victories and defeats as the new nature battles with the tent in which it resides. The old man, the old nature, the flesh. Galatians 5:17 says, for the desires of the flesh are against the spirit, and the desires of the spirit are against the flesh, for these are opposed to each other to keep you from doing the things you want to do. Ladies, we will struggle. The Apostle Paul knew this struggle. Meet me in Romans 7, verse 14. This is Paul the Apostle speaking about himself. We know that the law is spiritual, but I am unspiritual, sold as a slave to sin. I do not understand what I do. For what I want to do, I do not do. But what I hate, I do. And if I do what I do not want to do, I agree that the law is good. As it is, it's no longer I myself who do it, but it is sin living within me. I know that nothing good lives in me, that is in my sinful nature. For I have the desire to do what is good, but I cannot carry it out. For what I do is not the good I want to do. No, the evil I do not want to do, this I keep on doing. Now, if I do what I do not want to do, it's no longer I who do it, but it is the sin living in me that does it. So I find this law at work. When I want to do good, evil is right there with me. For in my inner being, I delight in God's law. But I see another law at work in the members of my body, waging war against the law of my mind and making me a prisoner of the law of sin at work within my members. What a wretched man I am. Who will rescue me from this body of death? Thanks be to God through Jesus Christ, our Lord. Jesus Christ saves us from this body of sin and death. Paul's struggle, ladies, is our struggle. And our enemy, Satan, knows that we have this struggle. And he uses every trick in his book. And believe me, he's got some unbelievable tricks. He uses every trick in his book to lie to us and to separate us from Christ. He knows he cannot have you. You are Christ's child. He knows he's not going to win you back. You belong to Jesus. But the fact is, he's going to do everything he can do to make your walk on this earth unproductive. And so he uses guilt, and he uses shame, and he uses our desire to be holy. And he says, you blew it again, didn't you? You were supposed to have quiet time yesterday, and you let all the work you had to do get in the way. And you call yourself a Christian. That's the lie of the enemy. God will make you holy. But the enemy will use everything he can to draw us away from Jesus. How many of you know that when you are trying and trying and trying to do the right thing, and then you just fail and you fail and you fail. How many of you have felt that pull you away from Jesus? How many of you have said, you know, he doesn't want to talk to me. I'm not going to do my quiet time today because I blew it yesterday. I've disappointed him again. The enemy wants you to think that. He's in Revelations, he's called the accuser of the brethren. So what's our answer? How do we win this battle? Thanks be to God through Jesus Christ. This battle is won. When we have that intimate relationship with him, when we know like we know like we know how much he loves us, then we desire to say yes, and we have his power to say yes. I don't know if any of you are familiar with Billy Graham's grandson. His name is, I'm going to blow this name, Tullian Chivijan, I believe is how you say it. He wrote a lot of really awesome books, but his latest book is called One Way Love, Inexhaustible Grace for an Exhausted World. And in a recent interview about that book, this is what Tullian said. He said, the Bible is not a record of the blessed good, but rather the blessed bad. The Bible is not a witness to the best people making it up to God. It's a witness of God making it down to the worst people. The Bible is one long story of God meeting our rebellion with his rescue, our sin with his salvation, our failure with His favor. Our guilt with His grace. Our badness with His goodness. So if we read the Bible asking first, what would Jesus do, instead of asking, what has Jesus done? We'll miss the good news that alone can set us free. The Bible is not the work of the redeemed, but the work of the Redeemer. This means that the Bible is not first a recipe book for Christian living, but a book of a revelation book of Jesus, who is the answer to our unchristian living. But how do we get the reality of this amazing love from here to here? I'm just going to give you a couple of practical ways that might help. The first one is to sit at His feet. Remember the story of Mary and Martha. Jesus was going to come visit them at their home, and Martha was a do-do-doer. And Martha was doing wonderful good things. All good things for Jesus she was doing. And Mary sat at His feet and listened and learned and watched. And when Martha came to Jesus and said, Jesus, you know, tell my sister to help me because, you know, I've got all this work to do. And Jesus said, whoa. Mary has chosen what is best. Sit at His feet, ladies. And then search for truth. Search for truth about what God really thinks and feels about you. When you read passages that talk about His amazing love, put your name in it. When you read John 3:16, for God so loved Sherry that He gave His only Son. When you read Zephaniah 3:17, He will take great delight in you, Lisa. In His love, He will no longer rebuke you, but will rejoice over you with singing. Personalize it. Ask God to write you a love letter. I know that sounds bizarre, but sit down in your quiet time one day, open your journal, and say, Lord, I want You to tell me what You think about me, or speak to me, Lord. I need to hear from You. And then start the letter, Dear Mary. Or better still, I have a woman that I coach she's just madly, passionately in love with Jesus, and she really gets how much He loves her. She calls Him her Abba Daddy. And when she is in her journal and she writes, and He's writing to her, it says, Dear Kinsey Girl. She's from Anniston, Alabama. And He says, Dear Kinsey Girl. And when she told me that, I just thought, how cool is that? That He, you know, she's got a pet name for herself from God. And I started to write her emails and say, Hey, Kinsey Girl. And then I thought, how dare you? That's God's name for her. So find a pet name. Dear sweet baby Mary. And then, wait. You just put in the greeting, Dear me. And then wait and ask Him to speak. And you sit at His feet and wait until He gives you the words. And He will give you the words. He will speak to you. And when God's amazing love finally pierces the depth of your heart, your life will be changed forever. And submission and holy living will no longer be a chore or a duty. It will be a joy. Ladies, will you worship with me? again for his amazing love.
Mary, that was awesome. I just wanted to share, yes, when we sat down and we talked about who was going to teach on what, you should have seen us all at the table. You do that one on submission to your husband. No, you do that one on submission to your husband. Mary, you just took a passage of Scripture that none of us like, really, and you turned it all over. Why do we make that about us? Why do we make that whole submission piece about us and how hard it's going to be for us to submit to our husbands? I mean, really. Mary, that was awesome. Thank you.